But when it comes to doing commercial music that makes money, that's a business that you might want to buy a house, raise some kids, put them through college, buy a new car. If you want to do that kind of stuff, you've got to toe the line and you've got to become a performer. You've got to become an entertainer. You've got to be able to move around. You got to look good. You got to show up. You got to get along with everybody in the band. And then if you can play, that's something that's kind of on the side.
Welcome to episode 110 of the Bass Shed Podcast. My name is Ryan Roberts. All right, what's up, folks? What's up, folks? Welcome to episode 110 of the Bass Shed Podcast. On the episode is Kenny Lee Lewis. I met Kenny Lee Lewis at the NAMM show. Man, when was the NAMM show? It seems like it's all a blur. The NAMM show back in May. No, this is May. Back in April. The NAMM show was last month in April. I met Kenny Lee Lewis at the Labella booth at NAMM, and I will talk more about what was so fascinating to me about meeting Kenny and a little bit more about his professional resume in just a second. All right. For regular listeners of the podcast, you may have noticed that I had not released some episodes as regularly. I was just straight up, I got busy. I was so busy. And that's not the, like, I'm so busy, check me out. No, it was just, like, busy. Like, just busy stuff. You know, there's a lot of things going on. Like, one, I got in a car accident. You know, like, that's not a check me out, look how busy I am. That's just, like, oh, crap. Now I got to deal with all this insurance stuff and get a new car. So that happened. Then it was NAMM. And then I got called to do some fly dates. I was in Mexico City and Panama. So there was just a lot. There was a lot going on for like the last, I don't know, maybe month and a half. But we're back. We're back, baby. Yes. Yeah. NAMM was cool. That's where I met the guest, Kenny Lee Lewis. Like I mentioned, I will talk more about him in a second. The gigs in Panama and Mexico City were cool. I was playing with a Turkish flute player. The only reason that's funny is because that's not like a normal gig I get called for. I don't typically get called for the Turkish flute player gigs. I'm not on the Turkish flute player scene. But it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun playing world music with dudes who know how to play world music. But yeah, when we were in Panama, the drummer, Chris Wabich, was singing Van Halen. Pretty much nonstop while we were there, which was great. And that band should have worked up a cover of Van Halen's Panama while in Panama. What else has been going on? The Bass Shed Academy has another, has the summer workshops coming up on June 24th. There'll be more information about that at thebassshedacademy.org. Also, there's performance opportunities for upright players if you are in or around Southern California. There's going to be, we're doing a couple performance groups, two kind of tiers, at least two, depending on what the response is from the public. Maybe we'll add a third for like really advanced. But there's performance opportunities for the youngsters. There's a high school age double bass trio class. We're playing all repertoire arranged for three double basses. And then there'll be a collegiate level of the same type of vibe. So that's happening. That'll be happening in, when is that happening? That's happening in September. Again, more information about that at the BassShedAcademy.org. Kenny Lee Lewis is on the podcast. Kenny Lee Lewis is a guitarist, a bassist, a producer, a songwriter. I don't want to say his main gig, but the gig he's had for around 40 years has been the Steve Miller Band. Kenny Lee Lewis has also worked with Bonnie Raitt, Eddie Money, Peter Frampton, Boz Scaggs, Brian Wilson, and Stephen Stills. Yeah, he's all over the place. He's all over, really plugged into the music business, and he will talk about that. He will talk about the music business. As I mentioned, I met Kenny Lee Lewis at the NAMM show. We're both at the Labella booth. So me and Kenny were both there checking out some basses, and then he starts talking about this bass. Starts talking about this bass he's got. And this bass was incredibly captivating to me. After he tells me like a little bit about it, he shows me some pictures of it. I'm like, dude, you got to come on the podcast. You got to talk about this bass at the podcast. He's like, all right, yeah. So he sends me this Dropbox file with a bunch of pictures of the building process of this bass and some write-ups on it and like letters of authenticity. But here's the bass. The bass is the Franklin Founding Father 5. It is his signature bass. It is the Model 4F, right? Franklin Founding Father 5. It's a 5-string bass, obviously. That's the 5 at the end. Now, the Franklin Founding Father, let's take a look at this portion. The body of the bass is from a rafter from Benjamin Franklin's house, where Benjamin Franklin was born. Right, here's the write-up that Kenny sent me on it. The body of this bass was reclaimed from 500-year-old piece of spruce, cut from a large beam from the house where Benjamin Franklin was born on January 17th, 1709, at 1 Milk Street in Boston, Massachusetts. If you count the rings from the bottom left end, we see that the tree was at least 200 years old at the time it was harvested and cut. Now, I will have pictures on YouTube about this and, like, you know, the video interview portion with some fly-in images so everybody can see it. So definitely stop by the YouTube channel for the bass shed and check out these videos. They'll also be online and in the show notes. Super, super cool story. Super cool bass. Super cool bass. Again, that is the Franklin Founding Father 5. The Kenny Lee Lewis signature. And man, this is one of a kind. One of a kind. And honestly, the best bass I came across at the NAMM show. And here it is. Here's Kenny talking about it himself. Bassist, guitarist, producer, and songwriter, Kenny Lee Lewis.
Kenny, how you doing, man?
I'm doing okay. Are we? Are you going to be okay today?
Yeah, I'm going to be all right. I think I'm going to make it through.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for having me. I mean, I didn't want you to have to, you know, do this while you were at school.
No big deal.
Teaching? Are you taking a class? Or?
Oh no. I'm playing workshops here.
Playing the workshop. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm like, you know, I play along for the students to play with.
Okay. All right. So you've got a little studio there that you can use. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. A little bit. Where are you at, man? Your studio looks great.
This is my warehouse. I've got shit laying everywhere because I've been doing tons of, you know, just running in and out. And I've been like working on, you know, yard work and mixing. I've been producing a couple tracks I've been doing. And anyway, but I just haven't had time to clean up everything. So it's sure. Just a mess.
What kind of things are you producing?
I just produced a track for a girl named Linda McKenzie. She's a writer out of Nashville, and she wrote a song about a year and a half ago called Missing, which dealt with the missing and murdered Indigenous women issue that is all over North America. And we did a track for it. She did a video for it. It turned out so good that we had it nominated for a NAMMY, which is the Native American Music Awards last year. And I think she put it in the wrong category because she didn't win, but okay. It got a lot of accolades. In fact, we got a couple of gigs out of it up in Canada, which was nice.
Oh, killer.
This one is a song she wrote to honor Chief Joseph, who was the legendary chief of the Nez Perce, or Perce as they say, Nez Perce tribe up in Idaho back during the, you know, 150 years ago, whatever. Yeah, yeah. So called Spirit Horses, and I just mixed it yesterday, and she's all excited, and she's probably going to move forward to a video now. So hopefully this one will get in the right category, and we'll win an Emmy next year. So
yeah, did you play on it also?
Yeah, I played everything. She played the acoustic guitar, basically, and did a really great job. And I just did everything else. Okay. We had a Native American friend come in. He played some hand drum and sang, and kind of added a little more Native American flavor to it, which is really nice. But it's basically, you know, like a pop Americana rock country piece.
Okay.
It's, you know, very different.
Very cool. Very cool. So obviously, I mean, you know this. I met you at NAMM, and I know that you're playing with Steve Miller. How long? Talk about how long you've been playing with Steve and how you got the gig.
Okay, I've been playing with Steve for 41 years now. 42 years ago, as of 1981, I think it was around September, I was going for my third record deal with some friends, and we had been written a bunch of songs, one of which member of this particular group was a guy by the name of Gary Malibur, very famous studio drummer and played on a bunch of big hits, going all the way back to Moon Dance with Van
Oh, wow.
Morrison back in the day. And,
Yeah, yeah.
Money, Peter Frampton, Jackson Browne, Bonnie Raitt, it
Okay.
just tons of credits. And he played on most of Steve Miller's hits. And
Okay.
so Steve called one day while we were mixing. We had eight tracks that we were going to like submit to get into a record deal. And Steve called and he was dry looking for material. And this was like I said, around September 81. And Gary came in from the phone call and we were all in their garage. And he just said, "Hey, what do you think? Should we send our demos to Steve? He might record one of these." And we went, "Okay." And so we sent him all eight mixes. And guess what? He took all eight songs.
Really?
So he cleaned us out. So we didn't have any project anymore. We didn't have. And he loved the masters so much that we'd recorded on an 80-8 TAC. In fact, I've got one sitting right over here with DBX. He transferred those masters to 24 track. He brought a truck over to our garage and continued mixing this record at Capitol Records. And I didn't know him. Of course, I was a fan of his when I was a kid. And then gave him my number. And at some point, he called me and said, "Look, I love your bass and guitar playing on all these tracks. Would you please come to Capitol and help me finish this record?" And that's how I met him, and that's how I got started working with him. So we finished the record, came out before Christmas in '81, and didn't get any push from the label because at those days, payola was a thing, and he wouldn't pay it. And we just didn't have any single support from Capitol or nothing. And the record came out in '82. We were rehearsing to go on a pretty pedestrian US tour to try to promote the album, if you will, with no single. And fortunately, his manager had negotiated, unbeknownst, I think, to even Steve, that he had a worldwide deal with Polygram Mercury. And Capitol was just US and Canada. So Polygram Mercury got a hold of it. They loved Abracadabra, the song that I helped produce. And it went number one in Europe. And so we changed our whole tour around and we went to Europe and became number one. And we sold 5 million copies and came to the US and went number one almost three times here. And I co-wrote three of the songs on the album and helped co-produce, the record. As I said, I didn't get credit on that album, but I did get credit on the next album, which was Italian X-Rays. But I was a new guy, so, he didn't want to get too, he didn't want to be generous with the credits, But anyway, that's how it started. And so in '82 is when he asked me to quit my studio musician business that I was doing very well in Los Angeles as a bass player. And he invited me to join the band and come out and su support the tour. I didn't have to audition or anything because I was already on the record.
So what were those eight tunes? What were
They were, well, I mean, Cool Magic was the second single on the album, which I wrote. And I brought Gary in to kind of help me with some of the lyrics. So he's a co-writer on that. And the flip side of the single in Europe was Never Say No, same situation. We also had another guy named John Massaro that came in. And then we had another one called, God, I can't remember now. Anyway, there was three. And then the other five were songs that Gary and John had written with Lonnie Turner, the former bass player for Steve Miller, and Greg Douglas, the guy that wrote Jungle Love, along with Lonnie. And so they were between those four people, we got eight titles on that record. Now, Abracadabra itself was a song left over from the album prior. It was a track, and he had lyrics for it. It was called Macho Children. And it was just awful. And we just said, come on, Steve, this track is great. Don't throw it out. Because he wanted to throw it out. And we said, "This track is great, man. It's got a really cool hump." Gerald Johnson played bass, Gary. Byron Allred was playing keyboards on it. And we just said, just let's just write some new lyrics. So I was actually supposed to write with him. And he ended up doing it himself. He saw Diana Ross at some celebrity ski thing going on in Idaho. And he got inspired. He always had a crush on her. He had done Hullabaloo with her in the Four Tops back in 65 with Barry Goldberg, with the Goldberg Miller blues band or whatever. And so he came down the hill and went in the bar. And of course, he wasn't drinking then. He actually had just cleaned up, got some napkins, and he wrote, "Every good ever, I want to reach out and grab you." And he just kept going. You know, black panties and an angel's face is Diana Ross, you know. So that's how that happened. And so he didn't know if that was going to be a hit or not. We just put the record together. And the next thing we know, like I said, Polygram Mercury in Europe loved that track. It didn't sound like anything Steve had ever done before.
Yeah.
When that hit, it hit with a whole new younger audience in Europe that thought he was some new artist.
Right.
After all those hits he had, you know. So it's very interesting piece of genesis, it coming back over the United States. And then, of course, it started playing like crazy here. And then Capitol, of course, you know, took all the credit, took pictures with us with the platinum records, you know, like, didn't we do a great job?
Yeah. That was all them. Okay, so that's how you got the gig. And then you've been with him for 41 years. Now, how do you, while being on the road with the same act for so long, how do you stay engaged in the music? What would you tell, like, what would some advice be to, like, guys that are just getting into road work about how to stay engaged after you've been playing the same material for so long?
Well, in this case, we have a heritage act, which has been around for 55 years, you know, and Steve's music is kind of become an American pastime. So it's a little hard to compare this to what a young musician might be doing if he joins a new band that's trying to break, you know what I mean? So in our case, even with Abracadabra going right out, we were playing a lot of the old hits, you know, Rock Me and Fly Like an Eagle and Joker, all that stuff. Yeah. So we already had immediate response that was very, very positive. The new songs, you know, the people were kind of like, you know, you know, when are you going to play Jungle Love? You know?
Yeah. They want to hear the hits. They want to hear the Joker.
Classic rock act when Abracadabra came out, which is interesting. That was 41 years ago. Wow. 42. Yeah, 41, actually. So that was our last single that we've ever had as a hit. But the concert industry for heritage acts, as you know, is still very lucrative. And the baby boomers still show up, you know. Mm-hmm. And even our younger audience that we got from the Deadheads and then the Fish people and anybody who likes Jam Bandy, Happy-Go-Lucky, Americana will come to our shows. You know, so we kind of get all those. Plus the old hippies that liked his records prior to the Joker, which were five. And those records were a lot different than anything that came later. So he's got like three tiers of audience. The old hippie dippy bunch, the kind of middle ground people that kind of like the greatest hits that came out on CD, all those college kids. And then the Abracadabra kids. And then all the kids of those people that heard those songs when they were growing up in their house. Sure. You know? So it's almost four layers, you know. And so they end up showing up. And to answer your question, our joy comes from the response from the audience. Obviously, we're playing the same songs over again. We're basically a tribute act for a guy by the name of Steve Miller. We just happen to have a guy named Steve Miller who's the lead singer. And so that's kind of what
the
it's
Steve
like.
Miller Band is a cover band of the Steve Miller Band.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
I mean, I was the new guy 41 years ago, you know. So now we've got a bunch of other new guys. And so we're basically just servicing the catalog. And the catalog precedes the man, which is an interesting situation because Steve's songs are so indelible. And it's not, he's not like a personality like a Mick Jagger or you know, like a Steven Tyler, where you immediately recognize him. You think about all of his divorces and his drug things and his cameos. He's done movies and television. He's never done any of that. So he's almost like kind of invisible. I mean, he could walk in a mall and a lot of people don't know who he is. Sure. Which is interesting because his music is bigger than him. So we service that catalog. So that is what we do. And of course, immediate response. It's great. We get a lot of feedback. As a performer entertainer, I put myself in the shoes of that who is giving service to the community. That zip code that day is getting a service. I'm a part of that delivery system.
Yes.
So if I'm in a new band, which would be something that maybe you were talking about with you, people that you're dealing with at school and stuff. You know, if you have a hit, that's great. You're going to get that response. But if you don't have a hit, you're just going to be playing that playlist that you have until something catches. And then just like with all bands that come around, you know, when you go through all the histrionics of being in a band like I did in the past, you know, you eventually might have two or three more hits if you can work that out these days. See, sure. In the old days, we had label support. They put money behind us. Even when we weren't a hit, they go, well, let's see what the next one does. You know, that doesn't happen anymore. If you don't hit right off the bat now, it's like, yeah, thanks a lot. We spent our money and we're going to move on. You know, so it's a little different. Plus, we don't get paid the same way anymore. We get paid for live performances. We don't get paid so much for a little bit for radio. Terrestrial radio is still around. And then there's the streaming thing, which doesn't pay anything like we used to get when we had mechanical royalties of unit sales of a physical product. You know, that was something that went away with Napster and everything else.
Right.
And the advent of streaming. So, you know, we've all gotten over that now. The old guard is finally, if you read any Bob Lesset's newsletters, he's always beating us up old guys by saying, you know, you guys got to grow up and come into the future. It doesn't matter that you're not getting all these royalties anymore because you're promoting your live shows, you know. Right. And that's where you make your money.
It seems like Steve's music is still pretty indoctrinated or absorbed by, you know, mainstream radio. Like, those are hits that are just timeless.
Right. But only on classic rock format.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
Radio, which is, thank God, still a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
On XM, you know. So anyway, to answer your question, I'm still skirting around it. You just have, as a player, as a young player, you just have to realize that you've been given a gift. If you have the gift, you know, and that's the other thing too. You got to have this gift that you're given prior to being born. It's just in your DNA. Yeah, you can practice a lot. Yeah, you can learn how to read. Yeah, you can learn all the scales and play all the chords and the substitutions. And it's still not the gift. The gift is something that communicates between your fingers, if you're a player, or your voice, and the listener. Mm-hmm. And they immediately feel something. Maybe they don't know much about music, but they can feel what they feel. And if you have that gift, they feel it.
Yeah,
they feel it right off the bat, you know. And so your job, because you were given this gift prior to being born, is kind of like you've been given like a job. You've been given this mission to go out and share that gift to bring joy to the flock, if mm-hmm. you will. And that's your job. Your job is to bring joy to the flock, not to please yourself, not to give yourself some little accolades and like, you know, I played so fast and I played so many notes and I had many chords and it was so great, you know. That is something you can do with your friends on the weekend at an open mic night if you want.
Right, right.
But when it comes to doing commercial music that makes money, that's a business that you might want to buy a house, raise some kids, you know, put them through college, buy a new car.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you want to do that kind of stuff, you've got to toe the line and you've got to become a performer. You've got to become an entertainer. You've got to be able to move around. You got to look good. You got to show up. You got to get along with everybody in the band. And then if you can play, that's something that's kind of on the side.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
You know, sure. You know what I mean? Because that's how you do it. And then that's just one facet of the diamond.
Yeah.
You got to learn how to teach. You got to learn how to design a product. You got to learn how to demo it. You got to do retail. You got to sell it. You got to go, you know, I mean, you got to do a lot of different facets of the industry to cut your diamond the way it's supposed
to
shine.
I like that analogy.
One facet is just not enough. You got to be noticed and to be recognized by an industry that's very competitive. You got to shine like a diamond, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a great analogy of having all the different sides and angles, you know, and even within one side, there's a lot
and
of angles.
Guess what forms a diamond? Pressure.
Yeah. There it is.
You're used under pressure, and that's what makes it become as hard as it does.
Yeah.
So, you're going to be under a lot of pressure in this business. You're going to be under a lot of pressure to deliver. You got to be able to bring it each time. You got to practice. You got to be, I mean, you know, when somebody points you, goes, play a solo. You know, it's like, you got to be ready like a year ago, for the solo that might last 16 bars.
Yeah, yeah.
On a recording or sitting in or, you know, because you never know who's in the audience. Say, here you go. I like him. I want to put him on my team.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, basically how it happens, it's kind of word of mouth. You know, you can do all these, you know, TikTok and Instagram, blah, blah, blah. That's all fine and good. Those are, you know, ways to, you know, promote your brand a little bit. But you still, most of the time when you get gigs because you've met somebody in the flesh, they've heard you in real time, you've moved them emotionally. And when you talk to them, you were clear, concise, and humble.
Yeah.
And ready to be available.
Yeah. Yeah. How are some ways you've navigated the changing of the music industry? Like, I think it's all still the same. It's just presented a lot different, you know, of things you were talking about, of the pressure and preparedness and, you know, playing is not even at the top of the list most of the time. All those things have probably always existed, but the way that they're interfaced with have maybe become different as technology increases and social media and those things you talked about. How have you personally dealt with that?
Well, I learned how to sing very early in my career, which is, you know, what I get paid for. I don't get paid to play bass and guitar with a Steve Miller Band. I get paid to sing and sing in harmony and blend and not try to be a lead singer inside the stack.
Right,
you know, you got to learn a technique to become like a horn player. You got to fit into the stack.
Yeah.
And you got to know where your placement is. You got to be able to breathe. You got to do vocal warm-ups every day. You got to do them, you know, at sound check. You got to do them before the gig. You know, that is really important. Of course, writing is another thing that'll make you shine a little more. Not necessarily the most important thing, but if you write, you're bringing something else to the table.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
you're increasing your value a little bit more.
Yeah, and with the DAW the way it is now, everybody should be able to write. I mean, we used to have to use tape.
Yeah.
You know,
it was,
I wouldn't even know where to buy a reel of tape because they were all out of stock, you know.
Right.
Look around to find a reel of tape. I mean, it was crazy. And, you know, and then, of course, you know, editing and fixing notes and all that. We couldn't do that. We had to be great immediately in one or two takes. You
yeah.
know? So it's really easy now for people to sound great on DAW. There's no excuse for people not to write, you know. I mean, when you look at these four chord songs that everybody's getting hits on, you know, these loops, you know, Ed Sheeran, you know, since he's been in the news lately, I'll just bring him up. Look at what he's been able to do with four chords.
I know.
You know, and a little ditty over the top, you know. Right. I mean, the guy fills up stadiums by himself with a paddleboard, you know, and it's like he has nobody he has to pay, you know. He just pays his manager and his agent, you know. You know, and that's great. You know, and if you could take that pathway, you could buy a house and a car and put your kids through college.
Yeah.
Know? So that is something that you need to think about. And then, of course, like I said earlier, you got to learn to get along with everybody. You
know?
I mean, if you can't get along with folks, if you're not a solo act, like, I mean, Ed could be, you know, he could be a dickhead and he'd still be as successful as he is. And he doesn't really have to answer to anybody.
Sure.
You know, but I think he's a pretty what I've seen.
Yeah.
He gets along with people and he does all right and stuff. So people want him on their teams too. So you gotta get along. You gotta be humble. You gotta realize that your gift that I mentioned is something that was given to you as a gift. It's a gift.
Right.
It's not something you do yourself on your own and made it molded it the way. No. You were given a gift and that's why it connects.
Yeah.
You know, and if you don't have the gift, you can still play act at it. And you might be successful. There's a lot of musicians I could tell that are very popular and very successful right now that I consider they don't have the gift. They just became clinicians of a art form that allowed them to present it in a clinical way that makes it so it's acceptable on the critical level, you know? And it's like, is that really enough to move me? Not me.
Yeah. 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 I mean, it's luckily a big world, and if people are looking to engage with music on that level, then there's people out there that are delivering that product, you know.
Right.
If you know, I think I'm more aligned with what you're talking about is I want to be moved by something first and foremost before I'm impressed by technique. I want to be emotionally moved by it. So knowing that that's how I listen and what I'm listening for, it weeds out a lot of people that, you know, maybe I should be interested in that I'm completely not interested. Because I don't have that emotional payoff. We got to talk about it, man. We got to talk about the bass. You know the one I'm talking about.
Yeah. It was an interesting project. Just encapsulated real quick. Some friends of mine in Rhode Island made a Telecaster for me as a gift. And, it came and I was like, wow, I was just blown away. It was real heavy. Come to find out that it was a piece of pine that was a plank in a shipwreck that was underwater for like several hundred years off the coast of New England, and it got reclaimed and they made bodies out of it and they made me this Telecaster with parts, and it, you know, it sounded great and I was really impressed. And the guy that made it was a guy named Riverside Vinny, Vincent Goulart was his name. He makes guitars. He's also into flooring and sculpting, and he does all this stuff with marble, and he's really quite an interesting guy. But we got in touch with each other. I thanked him for the guitar. And then he said to me, he goes, well, you don't have a bass. He goes, you ever had a signature bass? I go, come to think of it, no. I mean, I've been playing bass for years in the studios and then touring with Steve. And I've had a couple, you know, mom and pop ones that said, yeah, you know, we should make you bass, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, they wouldn't just do it gratis. Yeah. I'm not popular. I'm not that well known. You know, I just happen to be a journeyman blue collar musician that works for a guy named Steve Miller, which is a great position to be in, but a lot of people don't know who I am, you know. So nobody offered to do it. So I said, well, you know, I think I might want to make my own signature bass. Yeah. So he says, well, I got this wood that I just got from this company called J Mark or something like that. I can't remember the name of it. You actually have the certificate that I made.
Yeah, I do. I was reading that earlier today.
Proves that this wood came from a house in Boston on 1 Milk Street, Boston, that was being renovated with steel where the beams are. These old wooden beams were removed, and it just so happened that this house was where Ben Franklin lived as a child and actually might have been born in this house.
Yeah.
I talked to a couple of experts. They say it was a couple blocks down, a couple of doors down, but either way, he lived in this house.
Yeah, the certificate by the organization from Northeast Reclaimed Wood People say he was born there. They claim that he was born there. Yeah,
a really big piece of spruce, mind you, that you know you don't usually get a piece this big. Plus, it was about 200 years old when they were using it.
Yeah,
you know, so I had a really big spruce tree in 1709 or three, and made this beam that went in this house. You know, before we even had our independence. You know, and this particular tree. Was this beam was removed. And so the reclamation company got a hold of it. Riverside Vinny got a hold of it. He cut me, by my request, a jazz bass body with P bass 5-string wells for the pickups. I said, I want something different, you know, so let's go with the jazz bass body because I always play B bass.
Yeah.
I
mean, yeah. That's a nice, what is that, like a seafoam green?
All for the 70s and 80s because that was the bass of choice for doing pop rock stuff in those days. I mean, even the jazz bass was not used that much. I mean, I think the bass player for Blood, Sweat, and Tears, that was one of the first times I'd ever seen one. And then, of course, Larry Graham had one. You know? And that's when he started slapping and using the rear pickup, which is a story we can get into later. But anyway, P-bass, Wells, 5-string. Because with Steve, I need a 5-string because he's changing keys from time to time. Huh. And I want to be able to have a low E-flat or a low D to, you know, fill out the sound of the band, have some subs and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
So that's what he did. He cut me this body, just rough cut it, sent it to me. I looked at it and went, okay, this is going to be a lot of work. And so I decided to put this bass together as just an art project that I would hang on the wall.
Okay.
You know, my studio here, just for people to go, oh, that's kind of cool. And I tell the story. And so I never bought any real expensive parts. I just bought like a Japanese maple replacement Fender 5-string neck on Amazon.
Yeah.
It even had installed when I got it, and I bought some cheap bridge and electronic parts. MJ at Maricela Juarez, she's really sweet. She sent me a set of quarter pounders that she wound herself, and because we have sort of like a relationship with Seymour, which is great. And so I had all the parts, you know. And so I went, what kind of finish? I went, oh, I'll use tung oil. So I got some tung oil. And I did this bass just as a simple little project, and it turned out so great that I just went, you know what? I think I'm going to take this out and see if our manager sound guy likes this, because our manager is our front house mixer too.
Okay.
He's pretty picky. But he likes P basses. He likes just a plain, passive P bass. He grew up with them like I did, and he knows how to put it in the track and mix it, blah, blah, blah. So I brought it out, and he was a little reticent at first because, you know, it's pretty humble looking if you have that picture that you showed, you know.
It's just
natural finish, no pick guard, you know. And he said, you know what? This thing sounds really good.
Nice.
And so I don't like 5-string basses that are real wide at the 12th fret. I don't have huge hands. I'm really a guitar player too. I play both equally well. I played guitar for Steve for 28 years.
Okay.
That's what he hired me as a guitar player.
Okay.
Yeah, you can see all kinds of videos all over YouTube of me playing guitar. And then about 14 years ago, our bass player broke his ankle in four places in the middle of a tour. And Steve remembered that I played bass. He goes, you know, can you just sub for him while he's getting well? And, you know, we'll just go with me on guitar for now. And I did that. And when I got on that P bass, you know, and started playing with the drummer, who was the great drummer, Gordy Knudsen, we just locked.
Yeah, yeah. And
because P bass is the sound of Steve Miller's records, because our former bass player was not using a P bass. He was using like a Music Man Lakeland situation.
Okay.
And it just didn't have that punch.
Yeah, yeah.
There's something about a P bass, where those pickups and where they're split and where they land on the nodes on the string. There's a bass drum kind of a punch that you get that I think you know about.
Sure.
That, you know, you just don't get on a split pickup bass.
Right.
Like a jazz bass gets close. I've had a bass called a Kot, K-O-T at some point, that had some re-round Bartolinis, and it kind of got that punch.
Okay.
But it wasn't quite the same. So when I switched over to the Sandbergs that I got later, which were just like Fenders, but much more roadworthy, that kind of brought that sound back. But to make a long story short, when I got on that seat and I started playing P-Bay,
yeah,
Steve said, dude, you got to stay in the chair. You know, it's just locking, you know. So I, unfortunately, a very good friend of mine, and I just, you know, I felt really bad about the situation, but they just said, we want you to stay here, and we're going to get another guitar player. And I went, okay.
Yeah.
So I had to train the new guitar player on guitar so I could play the bass. You know, right, so right. I did that, and that was about 14.
And this was the Founding Father bass. Would you switch?
So there's Franklin 5. It's Founding Father Franklin 5. I call it the 4F.
Yeah.
Founding Father Ben Franklin. Franklin 5. So it's Founding Father Franklin 5. The 5 string. Franklin's wood.
Yeah.
And so I put a 50 cent silver 1954 coin in the front of it because that was my birth year. I put a decal on there of him, and then I signed it. So I made my signature bass that I'd never gotten before. My signature bass, and we're using it right now.
That's
just
awesome.
From the Jazz Fest in New Orleans, and we just played in Nashville. Sounds great. Everybody loves it. So it's just a fluke that it turned out the way it did. And the amount of money I put into it, it was under $200.
The whole thing? Damn.
Yeah. I mean, it just wasn't hardly anything to put together. The body was free. The pickups were free. You know, so anyway.
Yeah, I remember when we were at the show, I think we were at the Labella booth talking about basses, and you started talking about this bass, and I'm like, dude, this is the best thing here.
Show any of them, you know, when you put this all together, but it might be interesting for some people to see some of the genesis of how it all went down. Because I am a luthier. I was a luthier at 17.
Okay.
I was still just coming out of high school. I got trained by a really great guy up in Sacramento where I grew up, and I was doing frets and finishes back then.
Okay. Okay, did you kind of stay in that territory doing just kind of fret work, or did you get into building acoustic instruments at all?
No, I just did it when I was really young. Okay. And then later on in life, I just worked on all my own guitars.
Yeah.
Never needed anybody else to do work on my guitars because, you know, I do it.
Right.
I would do a fret job right now. I don't have all the tools, but I can do everything else.
Okay.
And I can even spray.
You can do say that again?
Yeah, I remember spraying lacquer back in 73 when I was doing it, you know, 72. I think 72 was still legal. And I was blowing the shop in Sacramento. It was pretty funny.
Nice. Do you play the telly? The telly that he sent you? Do you ever play that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I've lent it to a friend now. Otherwise, I'd show it to you. But, yeah, I played it a little bit, you know. I think I took it to one gig. It was so heavy. So the problem is when this pine got compressed under the ocean, it became as heavy as ebony. It's crazy how heavy this guitar is. And it's pine.
Right.
It's a pine with grain and everything. But it weighs a ton. Yeah. And it has a lot of low end. It sounds pretty cool, but it's just too heavy to sling around for me anyway.
We'll be back right after this.
All right, what's up, folks? A new thing I'm doing is offering up the middle of the show to you. I want this to be a podcast that builds a community, and I want it to be a podcast where you can not only hear, but be heard. So, how this works, go to thebassshed.com/podcast, click on the button that says give me a shout out, have all the information there, email me with whatever you want me to talk about. I'll run an ad for you. Whatever it is, you got a new record coming out? Let me know about it. You got some dates you want to plug? Cool. Let me know about it. Instagram handles, YouTube handles, Spotify, whatever it is, whatever you got going on. You want me to give you a shout out? Absolutely, I'd love to. I not only want to give you a shout out, but I want to go check it out myself. I want to know what you guys are up to. And I want the community to know what you're up to. So go to thebayshed.com/podcast, get a shout out. All information will also be included in the monthly newsletter.
Excellent, sir.
So is the Founding Father 5, that's the main road axe?
Founding Father Franklin 5.
Yeah, yeah. That's the main one you take out and tour with?
That's what I call it, Founding Father Franklin 5.
That's great. What else were we just talking about? You said something that was interesting. Sandbergs. You were talking about Sandberg basses.
Yeah, when I was, first getting back to when I started playing bass for Steve, I had a Carvin that was a 5-string that was pretty nice. It had like Bunny Brunell system in it. It sounded really good. But it was mine and I didn't feel like taking it on the road. So I said, Steve, I want to get a bass. So I went to NAMM and I've always been really good friends. In fact, Music Man is made right here in San Luis Obispo where I live. I've always been really good friends with, Sherwood first, being involved with bands with him, rest in peace, and then his brother, Erling, of course. And so I thought, I'll use a Stingray because they sound pretty good. And I went to NAMM and they had a vintage reissue 5-string Stingray. And in those days, they weren't cutting 5-string necks. They were just taking a 4-string neck, Stingray neck, putting 5 slots on the nut and putting 5 saddles into it. So the neck was really skinny.
That's too close. That's way too close.
Because I don't like a bass that's, but this was just a little too close.
Yeah.
And I played that for one tour and it sounded pretty good. And I went to the Cot that I saw the next NAMM show, which was really cool sound of bass with the rewound Bartolinis. It was kind of like a jazz bass look, but it was real retro and it was all kind of aged looking.
Okay.
It had a wangy neck on it. It was something exotic. And it sounded really good. And it was so easy to play. But unfortunately, it was just a little unroadworthy. We got it out there with all the different humidity and cold temperatures and warm temperatures and dry, the desert, And it just didn't hold up. Okay. So we let that go. And then that's when I found the next NAMM show. I found the Sandberg line, which I was very happy with. My friend Mike Van Tine, who's in the bass industry, hit me to those. And at that time, they were making Fender knockoffs.
Yeah.
And they hadn't gotten the cease and desist letter. So I got the last Fender looking ones. But I mean, all the parts on them were real stealth. It was really well built, held up great. The active EQ worked really well. Although at that time, we started incorporating more of those robot lights that have the motors in them with the solenoids.
Yeah.
And if anywhere near you, when you've got like high end boosted on like active EQ, they're going to pick up that solenoid. Mm-hmm. You'll have this little high little like a Dennis drill way up high.
Yeah.
Your pickups, no matter how well it's shielded. So we just started going passive with the Sandbergs.
Okay.
So when I built this bass and brought it out just as a fluke, we were already on a passive system because this is a passive bass, of course, that I made. But right. Those quarter pounders have got big magnets and it's pretty powerful,
Yeah.
And so that's how that genesis happened.
Okay. Yeah. I was specifically interested because I'm looking to get a Sandberg actually. So it's interesting that you brought them up because I've been researching them pretty heavily.
I think they have their own pickups, if I'm not mistaken. And now they're not doing the Fender look anymore because they can't,
Right.
But, with the longer horn on the top, like a jazz bass, it's actually sits a little nicer. I mean, that's the reason why I asked for the jazz bass body, because the P bass, the horn, is not quite as pronounced forward as the jazz bass. It might be an inch less.
Yeah.
And so your bass tends to be a little more, wants to straighten out a little bit.
Right.
So when you get that horn out a little farther, you can let go of it and it just sits right where you want it to be.
Yeah, it stays balanced. Yeah. But you were happy with the pickups? Have you played a Sandberg with the Sandberg pickups at all?
I played them with both. I think the first generation I had was another brand that they were using. I can't remember what I want to say. Remember the D?
DiMarzio?
No, it was a German brand.
Okay.
It was not their brand. And, big magnets, and they sounded really good. And then I think the next generation one I got, because I had this white one, the California Vintage Special or whatever. And then the next one I got, which was an ash one that was a little lighter, that's the one I still have kept. And that one I think is their own brand. And it still sounds great, you know. Like I said, I just play it passive.
Yeah. Okay.
It's so powerful. I mean, you have to kind of lower them a little bit so you don't blow up the preamp.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was looking at. Some of them were I was looking at earlier today, I think, are only active. And I don't believe they don't have a lot of information on their website about
about the 12th fret on the Sandburg is that it wasn't too wide. Well, the thing I think about Fenders is when you get a Fender 5 string, they're really big at the 12th fret, really wide. You know? And they do that to keep the spread of the strings, and I get that. But, I mean, unless you're some big guy with a catcher's mitt for a hand, unless you have a hand like a catcher's mitt or something, you know, to get around that spread, you know, when you go up high and stuff, you know, to play like high fill, you know, it's difficult for me to get up that high. So the Sandburg was a little closer to like what an Ibanez is. Because, you know, if you ever played an Ibanez 5-string, they're pretty narrow at the 12th.
They're pretty, I would always tell students, like, if you're going from 4 to 5, Ibanez is a great bass to start with.
It is.
Yeah. Before you really get kind of comfortable with that and then decide on the string spacing you like.
Right. And what I did is I just didn't bother me with getting that brand because, like I say, the Sandburg was the look that I wanted. It looked more Fender, like it looked like the retro band that I'm in.
Yeah.
I didn't want something looking too modern.
Right.
You know,
boutique-y.
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic rock band, you know.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so anyway, but yeah, this one I'm playing now is real organic because it's all. The thing that's interesting is it's all one piece. It's a one piece of spruce.
Yeah.
So there's no joinery anywhere. And so the wood, not only is it 500 years old or something, it has this incredible resonant quality to it.
Sure.
It's, you know, it's not pine, it's not ash, it's spruce. And I think people don't make bases with spruce because you can't get a piece big enough or you'd have to glue it all together. You know?
Right.
Very cool, resonant, aged, ancient piece of wood.
I love that story. Man, when you're telling that story at NAMM, I'm just like, dude, let me see a picture of it right now. Because that is the coolest thing at the NAMM show. Like, forget all these bases. Like, that's the most interesting base in the room.
Now, are you going to use some of those pictures?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to fly them in on the...
When you see these pictures, which I haven't seen yet, you know, you'll see how I was able to kind of put this all together. And I had to do a lot of work to get it to be just right. But because I'm a luthier, I was able to do it.
What I was going to ask something else. Oh, how long did it take you to put all that together, to build?
How did I do the picture?
To assemble the base. How long did that take?
How long?
Yeah.
I want to say a couple of weeks.
Oh, that's not bad at all.
Like that? Yeah, I think it was just before COVID that I did it.
Okay.
Might have been during COVID. I can't remember now. It's been a while.
That'd be a fun COVID project.
When you look at the pictures, it'll have dates, I'm sure, encrypted, so you'll be able
to... Yeah, I actually have them right here. Let me...
I can't remember. But yeah, I would say probably about 2 weeks.
Okay.
You know, my time, you know, because I had to do the tongue oil, multiple coats of tongue oil, and you have to let it dry, and you have to steel wool it, and you have to do it again, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I didn't want to put polyurethane on it. It was too cool to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd use tongue oil so it would be more resonant. And I couldn't blow lacquer because we're in California. So, you know, I just did the tongue, and it turned out really well.
Yeah. It looks fantastic. And then what's your amp situation?
The what now?
What rig are you playing it through? What's your amp?
Well, interesting you bring that up. when I'm here, check this out. I'm going to put this in my lap. You're not going to believe this. This is 22 pounds.
Oh, yeah.
It's made from a carbon fiber fighter jet thing. It's Italian. It's called an Aero GR.
Yeah.
500 watts. I'm going to buy an extension cabinet for this.
Nice.
When I'm live in town, that's the one because I just picked it up. That's the head and everything.
Yeah, that's a combo amp for 22 pounds.
When you add the other cabinet, it goes to 4 ohms. It goes to 800 watts.
Ah, that's insane.
Yeah, that's just ridiculous. You don't have to have some big heavy bass amp anymore. But with Steve, when I started with him, I was on SVT and GK and a couple other products. Eventually, he got tired of having to fight the bass sound coming up through the mic stand and coming up through his leg on the deck. So we tried using little suspending things and everything. Eventually, he just said, you know what? Go direct. I don't want any bass amp on stage.
Really?
Correct. And one of the reasons why this knuckle here, I'm going to show two fingers. See that knuckle here?
Yeah.
A little bigger than that one. Sure. Is because I'm bone on this. Because in order to play that bass as hot as I do in the house, with these huge shows we do, I have to have pretty high action with pretty big strings. Because we can't have any rattling going on or any kind of weird shit. Because I'm so loud in the mix that if you hear that, it's like really loud, you know, the you know, whatever you get from the frets and stuff. So I've been playing this bass. That's another reason why I made this bass, is that the Sandbergs, even when I brought the action down as far as I could, you know, and just had just a slight relief, it was still killing my fingers, you know.
Really?
Because I'm using like 45 through 135.
Okay.
You know, so it's a pretty big range. And I'm using like a 110 on the E.
Yeah.
You know, I'm using like an 85 or 90 on the A. But it's a 135 on the B string. These are big strings, you know. And it's like, around, you know, all night long, you have to have a lot of pressure. Get rid of that. Sorry.
No, no, good.
So that is another reason why I'm having a problem, you know, with my thing, because I can't move air, so I have to use my Future Sonic inner ear monitors to get my bass out. So hold on a second.
Yeah. Okay.
So anyway, sorry about that.
Yeah. No worries.
But anyway, he didn't want the bass competing with the chest sound of his voice. He didn't want to hear all that bass. So in his mix, he didn't have a lot of low end on my bass. It's a little more mid-rangey, because he wants to hear the chest of his own voice in his mouth, because that's his sound.
Yeah.
He wants to hear. So he didn't want a bass competing with that, you know. So
Anyway,
I go direct. And so I got this thing called the Basics. It's a English-designed little pedal that's kind of like a Neve on the floor that I can do the shelving EQ and a compressor with if I need to. And I can switch in and out different bands on it and stuff.
Okay.
It doesn't have a speaker simulator. It doesn't have a tube cylinder, because I tried using a tube pedal and all that stuff, and the tubes would fail and everything.
Right.
I mean, I had something that was like dependable every minute and every hour, no matter what the conditions.
Yeah.
And this thing has given me that. So I have that in my monitors. Not everybody else is hearing it, but I've got a thing that is making me feel like I'm getting the sponginess of a little bit of a preamp compression,
yeah,
and a little air.
Okay.
And that's how I'm able to get my bass sound through these things. So to answer your question, there is no amp.
Right. Yeah. Excuse me. I mean, that's kind of convenient, you know. It's kind of nice. There's less gear. And not that you're lugging around your own gear, but
an old venue, like there's a place we play in New Hampshire. It's called the Casino, and it's in Hampton Beach. I mean, Zeppelin played there. A bunch of other people played there. It's very famous, and it's upstairs. And it's an old dance floor. And so the wood on the stage and the wood on the dance floor is designed to be kind of flexible.
Yeah, yeah.
So I play there. I get the subwoofers coming through the stage, which of course drives Steve crazy. But man, I can feel it in my legs for the first time. I'm playing bass. I'm going, wow, this feels great. Because I can actually feel the vibration, which is really cool.
Yeah. In addition to the project you were producing that you mentioned at the beginning, what else do you have coming up?
Well, we're going to be heading back out on June 21st, with Steve. Yeah. We're going to be taking a swing through, you know, the Midwest. We're going to be doing some Texas dates. We're going to be doing some dates up in Canada, and then eventually we'll be doing, you know, the South, and then eventually ended up in the West Coast. You know, Red Rocks, Salt Lake City, in California, all the way up to Washington and all that stuff.
Cool.
So September on the West Coast. So that'll be that tour. You go to stevemillerband.com and look at touring for that. I have several bands of my own that I do around here on the Central Coast. I'm playing next week at a place in Pismo Beach. There's a place in Morro Bay that I play. There are some clubs in Los Angeles. I just went down and saw the new Write-Off Room, which just opened last week. A big band down there that my wife and I used to play in. That room
what
is really
band?
Nice. Also, Herb Alpert's Vibrato, yeah. and you know, and Brentwood is great, or Bel Air, I should say. And then there's a place called Bogies out in Westlake. I played all those. So there's some pretty decent clubs out here that I can play. We don't make a lot of money, you know. It's like, you know, all these places are trying to pay their rent, you know, and pay their employees and insurance and blah blah blah. California is very expensive, so. Unfortunately, the amount that we're getting paid nowadays to play live gigs around here is about the same money we used to make in the 1970s. Yeah. Same amount, exactly. Right. You know, but with you know, inflation not factored in.
I haven't been to the new Write-Off Room yet. Bill, the owner, I met him on a gig, He invited me to come out and book some dates at the old venue, but then they closed down. And I know the new one just opened up like a month ago, and I haven't checked it out yet.
Well, the new one is great. It's got the sound dialed in. It's a little deeper, okay. So there's sound cushion.
I mean, it's closer. Like, the other one was just out kind of in the middle of nowhere.
Right near Universal City. It's in Studio City, but it's just right up from Universal City and, you know, the park and all that stuff. So it's great, and I think he's going to be very successful with it. I have a Fillmore tribute that I do with Bill Champlin and his wife, Tamara, from Sons of Champlin in Chicago and all this stuff. And we did it twice in L.A., one at Bogey's and one at a place called B&L Saloon, and it was well-received. I'd like to start booking it some more. Just trying to get it in, you know, hooked up with all these other places so it jives with my schedule, because I've been not available. That'll be fun. And that's really fun. We do all the music from the Fillmore era, and we use musicians that played with bands that played the Fillmore, including Bill with Sons of Champlin, of course, who played there all the time, along with Steve. So, but we could change the book, and we could change the songs all the time, because there were so many groups that played at the Fillmore over the years. We can have a different show every time, which would be great for featured artists. So I'm really looking forward to getting that going. And then I've got a True Fire masterclass that I just did. If you go to True Fire and look up Kenny Lee Lewis, it's called Rhythm Renaissance. Okay. And I just teach basically rhythm guitar, because everybody on there teaches lead. I want something different. So I came in with some tracks with bass and drums, and then I showed how you craft rhythm parts to, you know, marry and have a conversation with the bass and drums.
Great.
You know,
that's great.
And show different parts of layering, how to do that. Because, you know, really, the Steve Miller Band gig when I came on board in 81 as a guitar player was a rhythm gig. You know, I was basically taking the Boss Skaggs chair, which was the original rhythm guitar player for Miller. And, you know, you just have to learn how to play rhythm. That's how you get hired on gigs, is singing and playing rhythm. Lead guitar players are a dime a dozen. There's a million of them out there, and they all pretty much sound the same, based on which college they went to or which school, you know. And God bless them. I mean, there's some great players, but I mean, lead guitar playing is secondary to the purpose of what a hit heritage act is doing on the road. We're replicating tracks and layering and parts and things that fit together and dovetail. If you get a solo, it's just sort of like icing on the cake.
Yeah.
It's, you know, people are there for the songs. They're not there to hear you go weedy, 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 weedy. They're there to hear a hit record, you know, great singing with great harmonies, you know. So that was what I was trying to teach. So you can go on truefire.com and see that. I think the course is only like $30.
Okay.
You know, tell your kids to go there. Yeah. And then I've got, you know, my YouTube channel, which has a lot of free lessons on it that I did during COVID. And I did interviews with a lot of big name people. Those are fun to watch and just go on there. They're free. And just like and follow me. I have my website, KennyLeeLewis.com. There's some activity on there, but I don't keep up with it as like I should.
Yeah.
I have a jazz guitar album that's on Amazon. Okay. It's a CD Baby product. It's called New Vintage. It's a jazz instrumental thing. It my other persona, which
okay.
is
nice.
Playing a Herb Ellis 175 with a wound G string.
Okay. You know?
So that's a whole other thing, kind of like a George Benson-y product. And then I have a book that I sell. I'm actually starting to become a writer. And this is called Skeleton Dolls, Children of the Tower. You can get it on Amazon in either Kindle or a hard copy. And it is a sci-fi fantasy novel.
Okay.
So to go into that market too, and it's been very well received. And if you're interested, go on and read the reviews. It's an interesting concept about twins who speak in their own language when they were little. If you Google that, it's called Twin Speak. It's actually a real thing,
really.
And I suggest, in my Stephen King-esque, Dan Brown-esque kind of style, that this language has power. It was the original language of God prior to the Tower of Babel in the Old Testament. It says we all spoke the same language at one point. This is that language, I suggest. And it has actually heal people and raise the dead. And of course, they're beautiful twin females. And so a lot of interesting parts of the book that, you know, make it interesting to all ages and all gender.
When did you get into being an author?
Well, I was writing for Guitar Player Magazine for quite a while, doing articles and things for art on there, you know. And I did a couple things for Smithsonian magazine, Smithsonian Native American magazine, because I have Native American heritage. That's why I was talking about the NAMI earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
Station. I'm kind of tied in with Indian country, and I go up to Canada and do events all the time with First Nations people. So I did an article in one of their magazines. It was published. And, you know, I just started getting the idea that I'd like to become a writer. My father was a writer after he retired from the state, and it's kind of in my blood.
Okay.
And, I've written a movie script. I've written, you know, quite a few novels, and I've written, I'm writing my biography, of course. But this series is a trilogy. This is just the first book of a trilogy called Children of the Tower. And I have the sequel written right now, but I put it out with some agents, and it involves some politics. And I think that they didn't want to touch politics. So I have another novel that's actually about fishing and rock and roll guys.
Okay.
It's called Sex, Fish, and Rock and Roll.
Is that also sci-fi, or is that just kind of a fiction?
This is actually a novel kind of written about me.
Okay. But
been changed because it's pretty risque. There's a lot of explicit sex in it, but I think it'll sell because if you've looked at all the series that are big on TV right now, I mean these folks are making love in every freaking episode.
Yeah.
I just rose my hand about, I got one of those, you know. You know, because I wrote it when my kids were still living at home. I couldn't put it out, you know, but now I do it. They're all gone.
Yeah, nice.
So that's called Sex, Fish, and Rock and Roll. And that's what I'm going to be selling to agents in the next couple of weeks. If I can get an agent, then I can make them look at this trilogy and maybe, you know, bring me on as a sci-fi writer.
Cool. Man, that's great. It's great that you got so much going on. Kenny, thanks for being on, man. Really, really appreciate that.
Thank you, man. Keep rocking, man. We'll see you in your town soon with the Steve Miller Band.
All right. That was my talk with Kenny Lee Lewis, who has been crushing it with the Steve Miller Band for like 40 years. So many great nuggets of just advice and perspective in what he has to say about career. Now, hearing about his base, the Franklin Founding Father 5, is what kind of how we started talking at the NAMM show, you know, and hearing more about that bass from him was super cool. Again, stop by the YouTube channel for the Bass Shed, and that's where I will have some pictures up. There will be a link to that in the show notes. So wherever you are listening to this podcast, click on YouTube, and that will take you right to the YouTube version of this interview, where we'll have the graphics of the bass and kind of the process of him building it. Super cool story, and one of the most fascinating basses I've heard about. So yes, thank you Kenny for taking the time, and that's about all I got for this one, folks. If you are enjoying the Bass Shed podcast, please hit subscribe wherever you are listening to it, and I will catch you on the next one in a minute.